There are farmers and there are ranchers. Most of the nation's farmers and ranchers grow commodity crops that are processed into the foods we find wrapped in plastic at the grocers. But there are also give-a-damn farmers and ranchers too. And they lead us to ask, have you ever tasted give-a-damn food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1369th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, I spent many of my early summers growing up on the grandparents' farm near Belfry, Montana. The farm was 360-acre wonderland for boys, and as it contained almost all the traditional farm animals, an orchard filled with fruit trees, a huge kitchen garden, pastures for grazing animals, croplands for growing plants, and the big red barn. Everywhere this boy looked, there was an adventure in living to be had and food to eat. Real, whole food, fresh from the soil in which it was raised. Then somewhere along the line, I think it was when I was away at war, farmers and ranchers learned to grow crops with money instead of time. With money borrowed against the equity in their land, they could buy equipment and chemicals that reduced the time required for them to work out in the fields. Today, the farm that sits where the grandparents' farm sat grows government-subsidized sugar beets fence post to fence post. The big red barn is gone, and so are all the people. As a citified adult, I am always looking to keep an eye out for that farm of my youth. A hunger for the farm's adventures in living, and most especially for its food. Those farms and ranchers are not easy to find. Indeed, the great majority of the nation's farmers and ranchers now grow commodity crops that are processed, wrapped in plastic, and shipped over 1,000 miles to where we eat. In commodity farming and ranching, whoever grows the most for the least wins. And least is what most of us eat in the confined animal feeding operations we call the city. When I do find that farm of my youth, with real farmers growing real food in real soil, I like to call attention to it in the hope that attention will engender more farms of my youth. One of the best ways to call attention to something is to ask questions. And so today I ask, have you ever tasted give-a-damn food? Well, who better to ask and pick this subject up than Will Harris, who is a farmer and rancher at White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia, and the author of Giving a Damn, A Bold Return to Giving a Damn. Will, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you know, it was your voice that got me. I thought, with a southern accent like that, I have to track this man down and put him on the radio.
Because I'm glad you did.
So, Will, I recently had the opportunity to eat a hamburger in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And it wasn't easy to get that hamburger because I had to talk my wife and my daughter and her husband into driving all the way up from New Orleans to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, just so I could have a taste of the Deep South. And we all fell in love with our hamburgers to the extent that I called the waitress over and said, "Ma'am, where did you get this beef?" And she pointed up the street to this green pasture. She said, "Right there." So do you have any idea what would make those hamburgers taste so good to us city people, Will?
Well, I think I do. The way that we raise beef in this country for the most part, and in truth, the way I used to raise beef was a very unnatural process, a process in which the animals, at least for the last half or more of their life are kept in confinement and eating a diet of principally grain as opposed to grazing forage. Cows are ruminants like sheep and goats. Ruminants are animals with more than one section of the stomach, four sections. And they are, they evolved to eat forage. But we have, since World War II, we've turned them into grain-eating creatures. And that impacts us in a lot of different ways. And flavor is just one of them.
Just one of them. Lots of different ways when they're eating grain instead of the grasses that they were in. Other plants that they were, you know, raised on forever. Making a big change that we really did. So, you know, always interested in how conventional farming became industrial farming, and now people think of industrial farming as being conventional farming and doing things the old way, or magnifying those technologies that we used to use, is something else. But to me, it really is conventional farming, because we did it for millenniums, and this new stuff that we're doing with equipment and chemicals and whatnot is really a kind of an industrial farming. Your thoughts?
That's exactly right. My family has farmed this land that we call White Oak Pastures since 1866. That's when my great-grandfather came here. And my great-grandfather and grandfather ran this farm as a multi-species, cows, hogs, sheep, goats, rabbits, poultry, multi-species, vertically integrated. Animals were born or hatched here, lived their entire life here, and were slaughtered here. And then they peddled the meat in Bluffton. Six days a week, they got up before daylight and slaughtered something. It might have been a cow, might have been two hogs, might have been 100 chickens, slaughter something. Employee would bring them to Bluffton, 2.5 miles up the road, and peddle the meat. And they collect for it on Saturday and do it again the next week. And my dad took over the farm post-World War II, 1946. And he transitioned the farm from the model I just described to you into a monocultural cattle operation. And the cattle were born here, raised to weaning here, then shipped to the Midwest. And in many ways, it was an easier way of making a living. You didn't have to know about as many different species, and it allowed my dad to become an expert cattleman, because that's what he was focused on. You know, my dad was a cowboy, and I was cowboy, and we didn't talk about deep subjects much, but I think he was very proud of the fact that he was an expert in raising cattle, whereas his dad and granddad had been journalists. I went to the University of Georgia, majored in animal science, came home and further industrialized the cattle farm that my dad had begun industrializing. And I ran it like that for 20 years, and I made money every year. It was profitable.
And then an apple fell on your head one day when you're sitting under your apple tree. And you came to the conclusion that this new way of doing things is leaving something to be desired. What was to be desired?
So, it's kind of what you said. It wasn't an apple, but it was similar. I fairly suddenly decided that what I was doing was not very good in terms of animal welfare. Prior to that revelation, I would have told you my animal welfare was above reproach, but it was not. We can talk more about that later. And then I quickly decided that, you know, in the environmental side of it, it's not very good either. And I decided to change. I did not decide to change the industrialized monoculture cattle operation that I was running, that I owned, to model it after my great-grandfather and grandfather. That was not intentional, but I started evolving it and then was struck by how similar it was to what my great-grandfather and grandfather had the way they had operated the farm.
And when you started this transition, all of the neighbors who looked up to you for being such a good cattle rancher, what did they say when you started making this transition back to the future, as it were?
You know, nobody ever said anything to me directly. These were my friends and neighbors and relatives, and you know, we've been rolling around on the ground since we were children, so we didn't have to go through that. There was and is a certain amount of resistance. That's probably not a strong word. When you're one of the boys in the club and you make the decision to do things very, very differently, it's not going to be a very popular decision. Now, nobody's threatened to burn my house or anything like that. It's not that bad, but I'm certainly not real popular with the conventional farming folks that are my friends and neighbors and relatives. We're still friends and neighbors and relatives, but I just do it very differently. And I admit I have been pretty critical of the way I used to manage my land and the way they currently manage the land.
What was the major difference in the way you managed the land then and the way you manage land now?
The way I manage land now is very focused on the cycles of nature. The water cycle from the rain, the mineral cycle from the soil, the energy cycle from the sun, many, many cycles of nature. And it's very cyclical, and we're very focused on seeing that all these cycles operate as optimally as we can. The industrial monocultural way I used to run this farm is very linear as opposed to cyclical. And we kill things. Homicide is to kill people. Pesticide is to kill pests. Herbicide is to kill plants. Insecticide is to kill insects. Nematicide is to kill. We very focused on killing things, stopping cycles. And it's almost an opposite approach. And it's far more complex, and it's far more enjoyable. And I think it's better. I think it'll last a lot longer.
Okay, that's a good place for us to take a really quick break. Today we're talking about giving a damn farming with Will Harris, who is the author of Giving a Damn, A Bold Return to Giving a Damn. And that's exactly what we're talking about, is returning to an agriculture that gives a damn. So when we come back, I got to ask Will Harris about how he made this transition back. What did he do? First step, right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back with Will Harris, he of White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia. When I went looking for Bluffton, Georgia, I quickly found that there's a lot of Bluffton's all over the South. Who the heck was Bluffton? Do you know?
Bluffton is built on a bluff. There's a 78-foot bluff. The 78 feet is nothing in the mountains. It's not much in the Piedmont, but it's a heck of a hole in the coastal plains. And Bluffton sits on the edge of it. And there was actually a concrete swimming pool that my great uncle built in the bottom of the bluff in 1920. Not many concrete swimming pools in the rural South in 1920, but Bluffton had one.
There you go. That would explain why there's a lot of Bluffton's throughout the South, and I was wondering about that. Now, you're on the coastal plain of the of Georgia, which means you're blessed with rain.
We get 52 inches of rain a year, and it is a blessing. And it comes, the other blessing is it comes fairly evenly throughout the 12 months. The changing of the season, which is May and October, are a little drier. The winter seems very wet. The summer seems drier because evapotranspiration is so much more in the summer. But we are blessed with rain.
And if you have rain, you also have green grass. And if you have green grass, I bet the cows love it.
We are blessed with that. In fact, we talk about carrying capacity in the cattle business. And we actually can carry one cow per acre. And that's I don't know if there's anywhere else in the United States that's any better than that. I don't know where it is.
Well, I'm from the high, dry prairie of Montana, and we certainly couldn't do that there. Now, having that rain allowed your grandfather and your father and you to raise cattle. You made the change. You had to have some kind of inspiration to a guide to follow. And the name Alan Savory pops up. Would you like to comment on Alan Savory and his impact on you?
I'm a big fan of Mr. Savory. I was, White Oak Pastures was one of the first Savory hubs in the United States. I went to Zimbabwe and spent about 3 weeks on Mr. Savory's ranch learning holistic management. And it's kind of interesting. I started on this path, in the mid-90s. And I didn't meet Mr. Savory until 2000 and, I don't know, 4 or 5. And by the time I met Mr. Savory, I thought I had figured it out. And, I'm a gracious Southerner. I would not have said this out loud, but I probably thought I knew as much or more about holistic land management as anybody on the planet. I thought that. And then I heard Mr. Savory speak, and it was clear he could run circles around me. So I signed up to go to Zimbabwe and take the pill, and I've been a fan ever since.
What did you see in Zimbabwe that was new to you?
Came to understand. I already had an understanding of how important the cycles of nature are, but there I really embraced the need to do what's necessary to have all the cycles of nature operating optimally, and that's what we do here, and it's imperfect. We're not perfect with that, but everything we do focused on generating the bounty of nature, and that comes from the cycles of nature operating optimally.
You know, in recalling what you said before the break about how the industrial model is one of killing things and stopping cycles, and what you're doing now is one of working with the cycles. It's almost as if you're saying conventional farming is working with nature, industrial farming is working against nature.
You know, when I was raising cattle industrially, monoculturally, and industrially, I prided myself on being really good at killing things. You know, every day I went to my pastures and looked for a pest to kill, whether it was a, an insect or a nematode or a plant species or whatever. I was looking for something to kill. And as a result of being my father's son and an animal science graduate from the University of Georgia, I was really good at choosing the weapons to kill those perceived pests in the pasture. And what I did not understand, but do understand today, is all of those pests, what I perceived as pests at that time, have a role in the cycles of nature. And it's just gotten out of kilter a little bit. And when I would use a pesticide to kill that indigenous species, another indigenous species would start to thrive. And I'd use another pesticide just to take that one out, and another one, and another, and another. And it's endless. And if what we do is try to keep it balanced so that we don't need those pesticides.
What happens when it gets out of balance on your new conventional way of doing things? What do you do?
Well, it's highly situational. I mean, I have to see what's going on out there. I mean, it requires a lot of study, a lot of knowing what's supposed to be there, what's not supposed to be there. And, we can talk about many individual examples, but it just involves being very closely tied to the cycles that are occurring 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in my pastures.
It sounds to me like one would have to be a lot smarter to be a conventional farmer such as you are today than an industrial farmer like you were before.
I would argue that smarter is not the right word. When I was a student at the University of Georgia, I studied genetics under a PhD geneticist who knew an incredible amount about genetics. Very siloed knowledge. Now, he might not have known very much about soil fertility, but I had another PhD soils professor that knew all there was to know about soils. But he probably didn't know too much about genetics. And I had another professor and another. So in conventional linear agricultural production, the knowledge is extremely siloed. And what I do is very, very, very general. I think it's almost a disadvantage to know very much about one discipline because you need to know a little bit about all of it. When I first started transitioning from the linear industrial model to this cyclical holistic model, I used to take a sinful amount of pleasure in inviting specialists out and showing them a perceived problem I had to get their opinion on it. And if it was a fertility expert, he diagnosed it as a fertility problem and would tell me what to do about it. If it were a horticultural problem, he would diagnose it as what wrong cultivar and tell me what to do about it, and so on and so on and so on. In farming the way I farm today, it is truly a blessing to know a little bit about all of it, but not too much about any of it.
There you go. Where did you start to make the transition back to the conventional future? You were a successful industrial farmer, rancher. I have to pitch. You're also a farmer, aren't you? You're not just a rancher. You're a farmer as well, are you not?
Yeah, the definition between farmer and rancher is so gray. I'm primarily a livestock producer, although we do have vegetables, we do have honey, and we do have other things, forestry. But to ask a question about how I started is I really fairly suddenly became aware of the unintended consequences of the way I was treating my herd. You know, I didn't like it anymore. And in fairness, I'd say that I became aware of the wrongs of that, not because I was particularly smart or sensitive. I was a bit of an abuser. I was very heavy-handed in the industrial methods. And that allowed me to see the unintended consequences. So I just started moving away from them with no real plan of what I was moving towards. I just knew what I didn't want to do anymore. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And it led me to where I am today.
It sounds as though you got to thinking, like a lot of the kids these days that want to avoid eating beef because it's cruel to animals. And maybe you saw some of that cruelty and decided, well, there might be a better way to work with animals so that it wouldn't be so harmful to them.
Animal welfare was a part of it. Land management was a big part of it. Later, the economic impact on my community became part of it.
In what respect?
Sir?
The economic impact on your community. What do you mean by that?
Good. So when I made the decision to change the way I was farming, it was all about the animal welfare and the environmental impact on my land. And that was all I focused on, was all I cared about. But what it did is I wound up hiring a lot more people and paying them a lot more money. When I was very industrial, I'd have 3 or 4 minimum wage employees, 52 weeks a year. Today, we've got about 170 employees, and they make well above the county average. And it has had a dramatic impact on Bluffton, Georgia, this little town we're sitting in. But I didn't do it. I did not do it to save Bluffton. And in fact, I was in Bluffton with a visitor one day, and I showed him the farm. And he said, "This is a nice little town." And when he did, I was waiting for the punchline, because the town had been drying up all my life. We can talk about that if you want to. But he was serious, and I suddenly looked around for the first time and said, "This is a nice little town. It has again become a nice little town." My payroll is $100,000 a week, 52 weeks a year. And all my employees live in and around Bluffton, except one. They're one remote employee. So, it economically had a dramatic impact on the town. And the town has gone from pretty much a ghost town to be in a tiny but really nice little town. It's very nice here.
It seems like to me the definition of industrial farming is that farmers and ranchers learned how to farm with money instead of time. And it seems like your returning to conventional farming has taught you that you can farm with time instead of money.
So it depends on whose numbers you want to look at. You can Google it and see. But I think that probably you'll see that today something like 15 cents of every dollar, food dollar, goes to the farmer. Well, that has impoverished rural America. It has impoverished rural America. When a consumer buys a dollar's worth of product from us, the whole dollar comes to rural America. Now, my farm is just very modestly profitable and has a terrible return on investment. It's okay. It's fine. I'm happy with it. It's just what we want to do. Me and my family have made the decision. This is what we want to do, and we're doing it.
Okay. Can you hold that? Because we have to take a quick break, and I want that. I want to know the secret of what made you do that. And your family agree to go along with it. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Will Harris, who is the farmer and rancher and author of Giving a Damn, A Bold Return to Giving a Damn. And that exactly is where the giving a damn begins, is that you turned away from the industrial money for the conventional right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Oh, yes, this story could go on for many, many hours, I'm certain. I'd love to sit around the kitchen table with Will Harris and just shoot the bull, so to speak. But my question right now is, before the break, you talked about how you turned away from an industrial model that would have made you more cash for a model that made you more of a different kind of cash, I guess it was. What is a different kind of cash? What were you going for that made you turn your back on the big money?
Well, I did not intentionally turn my back on the big money, but I guess I have come to realize that return on investment is very different for me than it is most business people. You know, if you think about non-depreciating assets, there are not many non-depreciating assets. There's precious metals, gems, maybe art. I don't think about art, but land, non-depreciating assets. And we own a couple thousand acres of land. We lease another 1,000, and we raise another 2,000 solar arrays. And because we deal, all of our equity is in a non-depreciating asset, we make decisions very, very differently from other business people. You know, I went to University of Georgia. I took a certain amount of business courses, not many, whatever I had to take. And return on investment is so important in business. And it's normally calculated based on the month or the quarter or the annual report. And businesses are deemed to be good businesses or not good businesses based on the return on assets involved. And if land is the source of your wealth and land is a non-depreciating asset, the quarter, the month and the quarter in the annual report cease to be less and less important. We make, on this farm, we make generational decisions. All our economic decisions are generational, not annual, quarterly, monthly. And, you know, I own this farm. We have a 6 people on our board of directors, me, 2 daughters, 2 in-laws, 2 non-family members. We meet in this little office every week, and we make the economic decisions about what we're going to do. And we don't even think about the month or the year. We think about much longer term, generation. I am the 4th generation. My adult daughters are the 5th, and they've got 5 babies, some of whom may wind up being the 6th. And it's a completely different economic mindset than a business in which is very linear and involves depreciating assets.
Is that not the core value in regenerative agriculture? The same kind of ethic that you just mentioned about making decisions for the future?
Well, the example I would give you is in terms of land. We just talked about how land is most of our equity is in land, most of our wealth is land. And when I was farming this land industrially and using a lot of chemical fertilizer and a lot of pesticides and a lot of tillage, I would have told you that I am a wonderful land steward. I am a great land steward, but I was not. And evidence of that is the organic matter in my soil had gotten down to 0.5%. Today, after managing this land for 25 or so years without using chemical fertilizer and tillage and pesticides, it's 5%, a 10x increase. Now, organic matter in the soil is not all that matters. It is not. But it's a good indicator. It's highly measurable, and it's a good indicator. And I'll tell you what it means. If you've got 1% organic matter, your land will absorb a 1-inch rainfall event. That's 27,000 gallons of water per acre. If you got 5% organic matter, it'll hold 5 times 27,000 gallons. So that's, now, again, that's not all that matters, but it's a good indicator. And the fact that we have changed the way we operate and improved the value of this land exponentially, the fact we didn't have a real good return on investment for that 20 years, it doesn't matter. We built wealth in the improvement of our land.
Tell me about your critters. It would seem to me that if I were a critter, I wouldn't mind hanging around white oak pastures.
Well, I think our animal welfare is very, very good. It's something we focus on a lot. Make no mistake, I own 2 slaughterhouses. I have a red meat slaughter plant, and I have a poultry slaughter plant. And we slaughter animals every day. But we do it in as humane a manner as we can. And I tell you this, this is something we talk about a lot. You know, everything you eat used to be alive. Everything you consume for nutrition used to be a living thing. Now, you might have been a plant, might have been an animal, might have been a microbe, but it was a living thing, and that's how you derive the nutrition that operates your body. And you know, we are in the business of raising animals, raising them humanely, slaughtering them as humanely as we can, and marketing the food that comes from that. And I'm very unapologetic about it.
I would imagine they're happy animals.
It's our goal to see to it that the animals are happy animals, and we kill them, but we do it in a manner that we feel like is as humane as we possibly can. I've seen a lot of animals die. Some at my slaughter plant, and some at the predators take down. Some from old age. Some from disease. You know, and when my animals, when we slaughter our animals, we do it as humanely as we can. And you and I are going to die too. And when we die, you or I, well, I'll just talk about myself. I don't know about you. I would like for it to be as humanely as we do it in our slaughterhouse. You know, I've been.
Good point.
Sadly been with people with death, and it's not pretty. And I don't know of a better way of going than the way we do it.
Good. So you've taken an industrial model and remade it. And in doing so, you rebuilt a community. You brought a community back to life. I once did a radio show with the Phil and Barbara Hamburger farm in Seneca, South Dakota, 25,000 acres of corn and soybeans. And after the show, I was heading out of the area, and I stopped by Seneca, South Dakota, because I noticed they were having crazy days, and there was some Boy Scouts selling hot dogs. So I thought, well, I'll stop and get a hot dog, and got a hot dog, and I said, well, how's sales today, kids? And they said, well, this is like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they said, well, you're the first customer. Fact is, there's nothing left of Seneca, South Dakota. And your story about rebuilding Bluffton, Georgia, is so heart-rending. I mean, my goodness sakes, it can be done, and you did it. But it must have taken a lot of gumption. Where'd you find that?
Well, I had the gumption. I didn't have the money. And I think that, thank you for those kind of words. A point I'd like to make is we have turned Bluffton from a ghost town into a very, very pleasant little place. If that's arrogant to say that, then I'm arrogant, because it is. Come see me. I'll show you. But what's important is it was done without a government grant or a mega wealthy person. It was just done by creating a local business that operated in a sound local economic system where the money didn't flow out. We talked about the fact that in modern agricultural production, 85 cents of every dollar goes somewhere else. Well, that impoverishes rural America.
Yes, you had gumption, but you had to get more gumption. Tell us about gumption.
Well, so
it seems to have disappeared in much of our country.
We call it grit, you know, and grit is gumption and determination and focus. And, you know, I think that we have that. The members of my family never have been known for being particularly artful or intelligent or musical. But, you know, we see to it that the job gets done. And I think that's what's happened here. But again, this is not about us. This is about the change that can be made in impoverished rural America.
Where do you sell all of your meat? Surely you don't sell it all in Bluffton. You must sell it everywhere because you're raising a lot of meat. A lot of beef. What else? What other animals are you selling now? Rabbits? We have everything.
Cows, hogs, sheep, goats, rabbits, chickens, turkeys, geese, guineas, ducks, vegetables, eggs, honey. So I built, and I'm sitting in Clay County, Georgia. Bluffton's in Clay County, Georgia. And Clay County, Georgia was the poorest county in the United States of America in 2020. And that has been a blessing for us, because we've been able to hire wonderful people because there are not many opportunities. But it's also a little bit of a curse because I don't have much of a local market. We've got a restaurant, and we've got lodging, and we've got a general store. We do some local business, but we ship our stuff to 48 states, and we don't want to. You know, I should tell you that when I built this business, when I built my first slaughter plant, I knew I was not going to be able to sell my products in impoverished, tiny Bluffton, Georgia. And I built it as a wholesale company. My timing was very, very fortunate, not clever, just lucky. But I sold Whole Foods Market and Public Supermarket the first pound of American grass-fed beef that they marketed as American grass-fed beef. I was just luck. And it, I built this as a wholesale company. I didn't retail anything to anybody for decades. At a point, the wholesale business started to break down for me and become less profitable. We talk about that. And we started selling online. The pandemic panic pushed us into that business. And it's just, until last year, for the first time, we sold more, a bigger percentage of our sales were direct to consumer than was wholesale.
Well, we have just a minute and a half left. How can we out here in the world, in the confined animal feeding operation we call the city, how can we taste some white oak pastures protein? What is
you can order it online, and I appreciate your business, but really I think that consumers ought to find a local farmer whose program they really want to back and support those local farmers. Now, if you can't find one, order from us.
And by going to whiteoakpastures.com?
Yes, whiteoakpastures.com is our website and our online store. Yes, sir.
And it's food that gives a damn. Because you give a damn. And if you folks out there like to give a damn, White Oak Pastures, Will Pastures, and the book, Give a Damn. A Bold Return to Giving a Damn. Just as simple as that, by Will Harris. A great read, a good person, a good family, a great community, and they did it all by hand, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't get any better than that. This has been The Food Chain. Thank you all. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
Michael, I really enjoyed that interview. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.